I always feel strange using the word advocate. I am just a dad that wants to get his kids to school.
Wow, that sounds eerily familiar.
What a pleasure it was to welcome my Twitter friend from Canada, Tom Flood, onto the Rethink Now podcast. Our stories are eerily similar. My experience of our roads changed dramatically when I started taking my kids to school by bicycle. Something should be so simple to do, right, in this age of climate emergency and air quality problems. But no, our roads are not designed for children, but maybe they should be. Tom and I discuss the various similarities, the striking similarities that exist on both sides of the Atlantic, and how we think things can change in the years ahead. Tom does some amazing work in combining the visuals he creates, videos and photos, with language, and he uses some of the skills he learned in the advertising industry over the years. The basic message is simple. We have to make our roads safe for our children to use. I hope you enjoy the episode. Tom, thanks so much for coming on, man. Really, really good to chat to you. I appreciate you taking the time out here to talk to me and to the audience. I was just thinking, we did speak earlier in the year, didn't we? Because earlier in the year, you set up some kind of online networking chats where cyclists from around the world could meet and discuss and tell their stories. You remember those?
Yeah, you know what? It's funny you mentioned that, Ed. Those were really great. And those were truly just born out of all of us kind of going through. It was the early stages of COVID. And we were all, honestly, we couldn't go anywhere. So we're all sitting in our house. I thought it'd be really nice to just finally talk with the people that we type with all day long. And it was really neat. I want to do another one, actually. I think I mentioned this the other day to somebody, but I'd like to do another one. So it was a really neat way to network and not just talk cycling, even though that was a lot of the conversation, but just to get to know people on a more personal, like, hey, that's face-to-face via video. Thought that was neat.
Well, yeah, I'm still hooked up with quite a lot of those guys online, and an amazing, amazing group of people. I was trying to think back to when I first became aware of your work, and I think we managed to pinpoint it because I remember seeing a video that you helped put together where you invited the mayor of Hamilton, I believe it was, to join you and your son or your sons on a ride to school. Was that the kind of the start of your journey in kind of cycling advocacy, or did it start before then?
That wasn't the start, but it was the first time that a television crew came out to film something, to be totally honest. But that particular idea was just born out of a local councillor here that's, you know, kind of adverse to making things safer for human beings, which is such a strange position to take. I still don't understand it. He said a few things in council that just really irked me and irked many people. And I just thought, you know, if you could just come to school with me and my kid, who at the time I think was 6 or 7, you would understand a little more, and you know, maybe have a more empathetic lens when you're speaking about people in council chambers. That was really the original idea, was, you know, just before you talk and say those pretty, you know, horrible things that have a ripple effect in the community when you are a person in leadership, you know, just see it through someone else's eyes just once. So that was the idea. We didn't get that counselor in particular to do it, but we got the mayor to show up to my house at like 7 or 8 a.m. probably. They all put cameras on. The mayor had a camera, like a little GoPro. My kid had the GoPro on, and the news showed up in the morning and watched us launch off to bike to school. And then within the first 25 to 30 seconds, a car almost hit Oliver, who's my child, and the mayor, who was kind of leading the pack. So it really worked well. You couldn't have set it up any better. But the reason for that ride, you know, we all see these things every day, but, you know, there's a good chance maybe you don't almost get hit live on local television, but it happened that way. And I think it opened a few people's eyes, hopefully.
Oh, it's amazing. I'll stick a link to the video if I can find it in the description so people can watch it. But was that really the start of your journey, or how far back do you have to stretch to find your kind of, when your interest was piqued by this, the need for kind of bicycle advocacy? But it's more than that, isn't it? It's about creating safe streets for us and for our children.
Yeah, that's a great question and way to frame it too. So I guess one thing I'll say, Ed, like you, I would, yeah, you do a lot more work in this space than I ever have. So I always feel strange using the word advocate for myself. I just always feel like I am just a dad that wants to get his kids to school. That's kind of always how I've seen myself. I always feel like that term advocate has a deeper and heavier weight to it, where people like yourself and other people that do this day in and day out maybe deserve that title more than someone like me who just happens to, you know, pop in. But I do think about it a lot. So it maybe changed over the years. But my experience was I was I lived in Toronto for a long time and biked around, biked to work, biked to concerts, biked to the bar, all things like that, mid-20s, and never really thought about the state of, you know, getting around on a bicycle. It was never amazing, but it was never horrible to me. It was just how you got around. Then we moved our family and took the light bulb went off when I first took my eldest son to grade one and then my youngest son to daycare. And we hopped on our bikes because that's what I did previously. That's how we kind of got around. So why would it be any different? And then, you know, a few minutes into the ride, it was so obvious, you know, the priorities of our cities and our streets. And it was just completely ridiculous to me that this was acceptable to one, our city, and, you know, to anyone else that wants to get around not in a car.
Yeah, well, you have quite a gift, Tom. I mean, the videos and the imagery you put on your Twitter feed, kind of mixing the roads that you and your family are asked to share with, you know, three tons of metal are really powerful. I've tried to kind of replicate it, what you do, but I kind of fall short of the heights and the standard you set. But you have a bit of a trick up your sleeve or a secret, don't you? Because you used to work, or still kind of do, in the advertising industry, and you even did some work for the auto industry, for the car industry. So do you have any tips and tricks for how the car industry works and how it's such a powerful force?
Yeah, that's my dark secret that's out now. So I began my career in advertising and working at a few different agencies and what had automotive clients. So had some experience working with them from a communications perspective. But as far as tricks and tips, I mean, you know, it's, to me, it's all about storytelling, regardless of the space we're in. And I think the biggest takeaway is to try to connect more on an emotional level. And not that saying that car ads do this all the time or they do it perfectly, but it's a good way to connect with someone and to connect across a broader audience that may not, especially in our space, I say our space, but in this kind of safe streets, road safety space where it's so polarizing, to kind of look to commonalities and stories that we share rather than trying to create division. So yeah, from a kind of a broad stroke general campaign idea to help shape perceptions and narrative, I think that emotional side is really important and something that can be kind of looked to as a template.
Yeah, it's too easy, isn't it, just to kind of label the car industry and everyone that works in it, man, how many hundreds of thousands, millions of people in it that work there, as being evil, some kind of Star Wars-esque dark side organization. I'm pretty sure that the people working in there, you know, they don't want my kids dead and they don't want your kids dead. They probably have good intentions, you know, on the whole, and they must, I don't know, they might see your posts or mine every now and again and just wonder what the heck we're on about. But the streets are not safe for our kids to walk and ride on, are they? And something needs to be done. Do you think we're going to kind of reach some kind of compromise, or do you think we're just kind of headed for, I don't know, the end of the car industry on the whole? I mean, if you look at the kind of climate emergency factor in all of this.
Yeah, that's a really big question. And
sorry, when I don't, on the spot a bit there.
Yeah, well, I should have studied a little more on this. I guess to trying to stay hopeful and optimistic, I would say yes, there is a shift and a movement moving away. But I mean, as a great example of right now is how we all went through COVID recently, and many of our cities and towns kind of changed up our streets and changed the way they looked and designed, something many, many advocates have been doing for a long time or trying to get to for a long time. And it happened relatively quickly or was expedited due to COVID. But the thing that makes me really uncomfortable is how quickly they're going back in many places, not everywhere, but how quickly it's changing again. It was kind of like there was this real, felt very hopeful. If you can find a silver lining in COVID, which I know there really isn't, but as far as things were changing on the street, it wasn't as busy. You know, we were giving over space to, you know, people walking, expanding sidewalks, making bike lanes. And now in places you can see it going back again, which is a something that really is not completely unexpected, but it's hard to see that switch go back, to try to get back to that, as everyone says, that normal that we don't want to get back to. But it's again, it comes down to that ingrained and insidious car culture that's just been inside of us for so long, over years and years of, you know, poor leadership, false narratives, all sorts of rhetoric, and wanting to get back to that normal, what that normalcy is.
Yeah, well, if it makes you feel any better, Tom, you know, it's exactly the same over here in the UK. Yeah, you know, it's a strange situation. You know, so kind of safe streets advocates like ourselves, were all of a sudden in whatever it was, March, kind of dealt our perfect streets. It was weird, you know, going outside and just seeing quiet everywhere and a real lack of cars, and you could hear the birds singing and all that kind of stuff. Obviously being careful and kind of sensitive to the fact that, you know, there's a real struggle going on as well for a lot of people. So yeah, there was a lot of energy in the UK and a lot of money, to be fair, put behind, creating or making the most of this situation and giving them space to walking and cycling. That has dissipated a lot in the UK in the last few months, you know, and it's been a bit of a kickback now. Whether it's related to kind of the time of year that's kicking in now, you know, you and I know that it's dead easy to ride all year round with the right equipment, but maybe there's a bit of energy being lost now that winter's approaching and we need to kind of rebuild for spring 2021. But at the very least, it did give us this perfect little glimpse, didn't it, into what's possible in the future.
Yeah, it was really, really amazing to see those early changes, those early onset changes that were, again, just expedited because of the situation. Yeah, it was amazing to see how quickly it can happen when it needed to happen. So after all these years of so much, you know, thousands of hours of council meetings and debates and motions and reports and studies, in the end, it can be done quickly, as we all know. I know this is not news to anybody, but seeing that happen so quickly in so many places really, I guess, is frustrating, but also gives you hope that it can change, you know, quickly enough if it needs to. But I don't know.
Yeah, well, I was taking this podcast seriously, you know, as I should do. And I was doing a bit of research, Tom. So I was looking at some documents on the City of Hamilton website. So I was looking at collision data, crash data, and it was quite fascinating, really, the kind of similarities. I mean, the data and the kind of statistics broadly quite similar. I think the UK does have similar-ish level, oh no, sorry, better levels of safety, although I do have my concerns about how we measure how safe our roads are. Which maybe we can talk about later. But yeah, it was really quite fascinating looking at the documents and just how they're kind of laid out. And they're very similar to in the UK. They're kind of devoid of any humanity, weirdly. There's no pictures of people using the roads. It's just graphs and little icons here and there. And there seems to be a real lack of a willing to, you know, to go after the elephant in the room. Have you been working with any road safety organisations locally where you are to kind of change the messaging away from the kind of high-vis helmet armband kind of way to being a bit more direct in how we actually go about making the streets safer?
You know, we have a couple of great organizations locally, advocacy groups, Cycle Hamilton being the main one here in Hamilton, and they do such great work day in and day out. To me, it's when you talk about the armbands, I mean, we see these same campaigns almost like clockwork. It's just like a tick on the calendar. Back to school, Halloween, which is actually really close, and summertime, and then back to school. It's like these three or four points of the year that you see a blitz of awareness where it's, you know, watch out. It's just a bunch of signs and a few images online that, you know, it doesn't really do anything. It maybe makes a few people more aware that kids are going back to school. I don't really know. But it's just essentially, you know, safety theater for everybody. You got people handing out armbands to the kids. We have something here called walk or roll to school day, which is great. And you're encouraged to wear yellow on that day. I think it's yellow, obviously, partly due to visibility. But it would be really, I think, be really great if we had our walk or bike to school or roll day, where on that day, instead of giving out t-shirts, they maybe, you know, installed an infrastructure or shut down the street properly, like we were talking about earlier, around a school. That would go a lot further to me, and I think to most kids and parents in the neighborhoods here, than throwing on a yellow t-shirt. Let's say it's a great example of it.
Yeah, I was in a meeting in Liverpool, across the water from where I am. I don't know, it was probably getting on for a year ago now, not quite maybe. It was an active travel forum, so it's kind of a group of people that care about walking, cycling. Are invited by the council every quarter to come and discuss where things are at and what's going on. And there was a road safety engineer in the room, and he talked about the three E's that they kind of live and swear by at the council. They were, in this order, education, enforcement and engineering. And I didn't quite have the wit or the confidence at the time to challenge it, but engineering should be first, shouldn't it? And there's a great video on a YouTube channel called Not Just Bikes, which explains like how in Holland, who clearly are like miles ahead of everyone else on this stuff, they put the engineering first, because when you have the engineering right, you don't need to worry as much about enforcement and education, because people just know what to do and it's safe kind of from the get-go by design. It's kind of weird how we don't do that over here, do you not think?
Yeah, and it's just something we just refuse to do, you know, 99% of the time here. And when we decide to move forward with, you know, the changing of a design here or some bike infrastructure, hard infrastructure, the amount of advocacy it takes from these amazing people that work on these files every single day, the amount of hours they have to put in, the amount of delegating you have to do to council, the amount of letters you have to write, it's ludicrous. And then after all of that work, you have this debate in council, at least here in Hamilton, and it's just the same old trying to convince adults that, you know, people should be able to move around safely. And it becomes extremely frustrating. So I do like to always tip my hat to the people that do this day in and day out, because it's exhausting. And we have some great people doing amazing work here, and there's amazing people doing this all over the world. And yeah, I can't tip my hat enough because of how frustrating that experience is, trying to convince people of something that's so obvious that needs changing.
Yeah, I mean, my local group is the Merseyside Cycling Campaign. A really good group of people that, you know, meet whatever monthly, and there's loads of emails, get bashed around. And within the group, there are a couple of guys that are getting on a bit now, you know, in their 80s, and they're still bashing out emails and doing the right thing and, you know, replying to stuff all the time. And I just wonder, is that going to be me 40 years from now?
I think so, Ed. I got to be honest. Maybe we'll be sitting on these calls in a bunch of years.
I think it's quite likely, I'm sorry to say. I did see on the Hamilton website as well, though, that you've got a kind of a pledge to go Vision Zero, or a Vision Zero policy. Is that right?
A Vision Zero policy?
Yeah, so people that don't know, a Vision Zero policy, you know, many cities around the world have adopted it as a system where if or when a collision occurs, or a crash or a fatality, measures are taken to address it there and then.
So we've been exploring Vision Zero for quite a while now, and honestly, it's just exploration. So again, when I talk about you know, going to council and, you know, and delegating, and many people do this quite often on things that involve kind of road safety and are related, obviously, to Vision Zero, it's not done through a Vision Zero lens, which is what that should be done automatically when we start activating that policy. And it's still the same old having to convince these people of something that is already written down. It says Vision Zero on our website here in Hamilton. There's discussions, there's some reports, and to be totally transparent, I've backed away a little bit, quite a bit in the last year or so, because of the experience of how frustrating it is and having these discussions with certain counselors and really getting nowhere and actually not even moving forward, but being pushed backwards, essentially. But yeah, so to say we have a Vision Zero policy here, yeah, that we don't. We have it on paper, just like we declared a climate emergency, which was a big win for us here, but we've done nothing about it.
Well, similar here, yeah, on Wirral, where I live, we've declared a climate emergency, and it was unanimous. You know, there was no kind of the actual climate emergency declaration. Politically, there was no split. Everyone agreed, and it was signed off there. And then, obviously, now we get into the detail, and we're struggling to get things done. There are a core group of politicians locally that really understand it, are really kind of supportive, but they're up against this wall of opposition, decades of doing things a certain way, and it's hard work, isn't it?
Yeah, Ed, thanks for bringing that up, because that's very true. I would hate to omit that. We have three councillors here that are really pushing hard for things to go the right way, and they do tireless work. So when I say nothing's being done, I shouldn't have said that. They are working very hard to make things happen. It's just they have a massive uphill battle against the rest of the people sitting around that council horseshoe.
Yeah, we had an incident, shall we say, locally to me, in the last 2 or 3 months. A quite significant piece of cycling infrastructure was put out to consultation to local residents. And it took everyone by surprise, including a lot of advocates as well, who kind of hadn't had a huge chance to analyse the design and see where it was going, that kind of thing. But anyway, it was unleashed on the world, and sure enough, it kicked off big time in the hundreds and hundreds of comments with all the usual stuff. And in some ways, I can understand why, you know, because I think one of the failures of this consultation in particular, and maybe many others around the UK and around the world, people weren't kind of briefed fully in advance about the benefits of this stuff. And you know, I can understand why, because if you're used to doing things a certain way, if you've lived on a certain street for 30, 40, 50 years, and you're used to shuttling around in your car and being able to park outside whenever you want for free, then this is going to come as a big shock. And that's exactly what happened. So we had all the usual comments about where am I going to park? There's going to be crazy congestion. What about disabled people? Businesses are going to fold. All the usual stuff you see in consultations like this. And, you know, it can all be easily kind of thrown out and kind of argued against with data. But people don't care about data, do they? This is a very emotional subject. So, yeah, it's fascinating. Hopefully we'll get this one across the line anyway, because it's personally, I think it's fantastic bit of work, and we can, you know, as long as we kind of speak to residents and explain it a bit better, we can get there. But yeah, I mean, you talk quite a bit on your Twitter feed about mental health and the benefits that you've had cycling to your mental health. I mean, on the adverse side, is this the world you've got yourself into in terms of safer streets advocacy? Has that had a negative impact on your mental health, would you say, over the years?
Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, for me, cycling has been an amazing. So I guess there's kind of two ways that I do it. One as just to get around town as transportation, and one where I go out at, you know, 5, 6 in the morning and bike around for 4 hours. Both feel really great, and I know it helps my kids. Biking to school gets some energy out for them. It makes them feel really good walking into school after they've had a good bike ride, even though it's, as we've talked about, a little tense and nerve-wracking sometimes. But being outside, getting some movement in, especially at these younger ages, they're 9 and 7, and for me as well. But for me, the mental health side really comes from some of those longer distance rides that I just kind of got into in the last couple of years, which has really changed things for me, just getting outside. And it's I think for me, it's just having an outlet for exercise, which is something I just never thought of before until getting a...
Yeah, it looks like you've got some really amazing trails on your doorstep, Tom, an amazing part of the world to ride your bike around.
Yeah, we're really lucky here in Hamilton. We can be out of the city in about like 10 minutes on the bike, and then you're gone. So it's really nice. It's really helped me. You know, I highly recommend it. I have no experience or background in having to recommend things to help people with their mental health. But for me, it was a real, real good thing. And it's changed things a lot for me.
I'll put you on the spot again a little bit here, Tom. What do your friends and family think about the stuff that we engage in terms of safer streets online so much? I mean, I have two versions of myself online. I have the Twitter version of Ed, which, you know, I talk a lot about, yeah, safer streets, and I throw pictures of my kids up riding to school. And then I have another version of me, which, you know, the Facebook version, which talks a bit more about guinea pigs and Nintendo. Do you have discussions with your friends and family about this digital persona of yourself, and what do they make of it, if you do?
Yeah, no, I do, and I think people, but I'm very similar in that way, having another social media account that doesn't really, yeah, it's a completely separate life for me. I mean, I do share things that are important and some things that are really worth talking about on, say, like Facebook. But those conversations, it's funny. I have like a Twitter life and then a different social media life altogether. Not that things change in my positioning. It's just, it's a different group I'm speaking to, speaking with. Yeah, it's just those conversations it comes down to, and I know we've talked about this before, Ed, but the kind of the moment you say, you know, it'd be really great if, you know, our kids could bike to school safely, like almost immediately are you labeled anti-car. Like it's not even being hyperbolic at this point. That's what happens. It just, well, you know, and there's this assumption that I don't drive, that I don't have a car, that I don't understand what it's like, you know, the plight of a driver and things like this, and that I'll never understand what traffic's like. And it's preposterous. It's ludicrous. Like I do drive. I feel like I have to preface this all the time. I do drive. We go all sorts of places with our car. I just also happen to enjoy, I prefer riding my bike. I prefer our family on our bikes because it's more enjoyable. Yes, I use the car for different functions, and but to me, and like all many of us, the constant thing that's talked about is that trade-off of, you know, an extra 30 seconds or a minute of traffic when, you know, when a city decides they want to put a bike lane in. I think the normal response would be, that's not a big deal. That's not really going to bother me, an extra minute of my day. So, you know, someone can get to work or get to school, or seniors can walk around safely outside. But it's getting really tiring and frustrating hearing the same old, you know, you're an anti-car person. Yes, we need to move away from the car, of course, but that's not some ridiculous moral high ground or position. It's just where we need to go. But I do still have a car and I still use it quite often. Anyways, there's my pro car rant. I don't know how I turned into some.
Well, it's the same with me. You know, I've been to council meetings and I've seen people kind of rolling their eyes. Oh, here comes the cyclist. And I've had to jangle my car keys at them, you know, just to kind of let them know that sometimes, I use a car to get around. and I am
right.
I am trying to reduce my dependency, as we all desperately are on cars. But sometimes we do get labelled, don't we? I mean, we also in the UK have a problem with the size of the cars that we're rolling around with. Is that the similar kind of picture in Canada, perhaps worse? I mean, are you guys the same as folks in America who kind of love their SUVs and their pickup trucks, or is the situation north of the border a little bit better?
Well, I think number one, generally, we don't ever like to be lumped in with our friends to the south but I'm kind of kidding, of course, but we have the same culture of maybe slightly less. And again, this is not coming from statistics, of course, because it's me. I have no research on this, but we have a culture that loves SUVs and trucks here too. Yes, absolutely. And as you know, they're just getting bigger and bigger.
I know. It's crazy, isn't it? And I mean, it's an emotional thing, isn't it? Kind of wanting to be protected by all that metal and that kind of the status from it. Do you think that power, that emotional connection can be beaten, or are we just got to wait for the end of the world?
It's tough to say. I mean, like to be honest, they're just getting bigger. And Ed, you mentioned about something you saw in the latest ad with these noise canceling vehicles that are essentially like wearing noise canceling headphones. So you hear nothing of the outside world. So when we continually move that way, the screens are getting bigger, right? There's less sound from outside. It's just, it doesn't bode well for the future, to be honest. What we're trying to, it goes against everything we're trying to move away from.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm trying to see a happy situation, you know, 10, 15 years down the line when, hey, we can celebrate because we've gone zero carbon, or we're getting well on our way, decarbonized transport. But, you know, because I talk about cars online so much, maybe it's the same for you. I see a lot of advertising because the algorithm or Google might be listening in to my conversation, this one right now maybe. So they serve me up adverts for Volkswagens and Volvos, and yeah, pickup trucks even for some reason. I'm getting those on YouTube at the moment. It's such a huge industry, isn't it? And it's got such power. And it obviously works, right? Because they spend millions, billions of dollars on this stuff.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's been decades of big budgets. I mean, there's not much that could parallel their reach and frequency. At this point, they are everywhere, in every possible media space. I know the budgets are big because I worked on some of them. And when you have that kind of power and ability to reach so many different people and target down to like a micro demographic, you know, we are being influenced. And I know it's the most obvious statement, but you know, some people think, well, advertising doesn't work, but it works in a bigger picture too. Like, it's not just, oh, that, you know, there's a car ad and I don't like that car, but it's the larger issue of seeing this for decades, right? And seeing how there's one way to get freedom, and it's the vehicle. And if you don't have it that way, and then you're just not doing it right. You're not living to your full potential. And again, that's years of these false narratives being pushed, you know, municipalities with weak leadership, tons of rhetoric over the years, and, you know, pop culture. You can attribute it to so many different aspects of our lives from the last 30 years. And again, it wasn't the marketing machine from the automotive industry is doing what it's supposed to be doing in the world we live in. It's trying to sell cars. That's what their company does. These are all obvious statements. It needs the regulation of government and leadership to change things. And it's just not happened.
Yeah, I think it was last year. I saw one of your cool little videos of your kids riding to school with some messaging over the top. And I think, if I'm right in saying, you had a bit of a dream where you wanted this advert, or that advert you made to show the Super Bowl.
Oh yeah.
Is that something you're still trying to get done?
So, you know what? So what that, yeah, that was really good. And then it was on the wish list, and it still is. I still think it'd be really great. And if it's not me, that's fine too. Just to have a spot, some media in a traditional space, of just showing the normalcy of biking. And I know this is not a new idea either. I know tons of people are working away at this, and I think this has been done, but it would be nice to see more of that messaging and imagery to help kind of reshape the perceptions that people have of what, you know, people on bikes are. I mean, at this point, you're just literally lumped into a handful of stereotypes. Once you're past, you know, 13, 14 of that cute age when kids are on bikes, you turn in, like, it's like a reverse butterfly. You turn into some sort of militant anti-car person, some hipster, some lycra road warrior. It's dehumanized. We need to rehumanize how people on bikes are seen. And sometimes using kids are a good entry point, but it's rehumanizing all of us, right? And all the different people that that use bikes, because it's not just this person. It's all of us.
Yeah, we had some temporary cycling infrastructure that was put in at the start of the pandemic, taken out about a month ago. It was kind of really short notice, and the council put out this little press release online to say, and obviously everyone kicked off, we still need it and all that kind of stuff. And we still do, actually. But the image they used was quite telling. So at the top of this short article, it was an image of a cyclist, right? And it was the typical cyclist that, well, you see in news articles. So it was, you know, tight lycra. I don't think it showed a head, so there was no helmet shown, but it was a sports bike. So it was a drop handlebar kind of road bike. And it's not the kind of cyclist, inverted commas, that I think we should be showing in kind of messaging that's going out, because you shouldn't, or you don't need a £5,000 carbon frame bike to go for a ride. And you don't need any special gear unless it's raining, in which case you might need a coat. You know, in the same breath, we've just had Halloween or Halloween's coming up. We've had the road safety messages going out about how, you know, kids need to be safe and be seen. So don't forget your bright jackets and your reflective gear, that kind of thing. It's a hard thing to get people to understand when they're not used to our way of thinking, but that kind of messaging really doesn't help, does it?
Yeah, and but it's really interesting what you brought up about the imagery used to on the proposed bike lanes. It's that seeing those images over and over and over for years and years and years is really what has shaped the perception of people that just hop on a bike. Like it's outrageous that, and it's really it's too bad, and it's I wish people, you know, if they just cared a little bit more and did a bit more homework rather than just grabbing the first stock image of whatever they find, because it adds up. It's the totality and compounding effect of all those messages that keep perpetuating the stereotypes of who people on bikes are. It's at every level. Something as simple as community municipalities messaging around a bike lane, and yeah, it doesn't end. And it's the few times people get to see a message around cycling, that's what they see, you know, and it's a shame.
Yeah, listen, man, I won't take up too much more of your time. We could talk about this stuff for hours and hours, and maybe we will talk more in a future episode. But what's the future for Tom Flood? What have you got on the horizon?
I think I'll keep on doing what I'm doing. And again, anything I feel hesitant to use the word advocacy, but any sort of content and discussion on social media was really just born. It was really just a creative outlet to, you know, air the frustrations of just trying to get kids to school. And that's really where all that started. It was just, this is ludicrous. I can type a few things. And in the end, I got to meet so many amazing people through this platform, which I had no experience with before. And I'm speaking about Twitter and meeting people like yourself, Ed, and people all over, which has been amazing. But yeah, so I don't really know what's next, but I'll keep developing some content and hopefully keep meeting new people, which has been the best thing to come out of this platform for me, at least.
I appreciate what you do, and I appreciate your time. I'll see you soon. Thanks, Tom.
Cheers. Thanks a lot, man. Thanks, Ed.
Once again, what a great pleasure it was to speak to Tom. I hope you all enjoyed that. Tom is Loud and Proud on Twitter. I'll put the link below to his profile, and also he does have a website where he kind of uploads the best of his videos and the short films that he creates, which I'm sure you will enjoy. Rethinknow.uk is our website if you want to have a look at the previous episodes or get in touch about anything. There's lots of other links that I'm going to stick in the description that we referred to throughout the show, so do take a look at all that stuff as well. And in the meantime, until next time, you take care.